as a society, we also have to worry beyond the interests of that employer. We want workers to get training that is portable.
Harry Holzer is a non-resident senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution and a professor at the McCourt School of Public Policy at Georgetown. He previously served as chief economist for the U.S. Department of Labor during the Clinton administration and professor of economics at Michigan State University. Holzer joined the Georgetown Public Policy Institute as professor of public policy in 2000, served as the associate dean from 04 to 06. He is also currently an institute fellow at the American Institutes for Research and a national affiliate of the Center on Poverty and Inequality at Stanford University, also been a faculty director at the Georgetown Center on Poverty, Inequality, and Public Policy. Harry's research is focused primarily on the low-wage labor market and the problems of minority workers in urban areas. In recent years, he's worked on the quality of jobs as well as workers in the labor market and on the links between higher ed, specifically community colleges, and the labor market for disadvantaged students. He's written extensively about the employment problems of disadvantaged men, advancement prospects for the working poor, and workforce policy more broadly. His books include Making College Work, Pathways to Success for Disadvantaged Students, and Where Are All the Good Jobs Going? What National and Local Job Quality and Dynamics Mean for U.S. Workers. A few months back, I got introduced to Harry through an article that was forwarded to me in which the title reads, Should the Federal Government Spend More on Workforce Development? So I wanted to catch up with Harry and have him join us to talk a little bit about what he put forth in the article. And if you haven't read it, you can find it pretty easily. You know, one of the things Harry talks about in the article is also based on his testimony before the U.S. House of Representatives Subcommittee on Higher Education and Workforce Development back in May of 2023. Harry puts forth a bunch of points of view and perspective, all that come back to the point that we need to do more, specifically for those in our workforce who unfortunately have not had the same opportunities as everybody else. He talks about things like the fact that millions of U.S. workers would explicitly benefit from additional skills training. He talks about how nearly half of all Americans over the age of 25 still have no post-secondary education or training credential. He talks about how while there are many federal employment and training programs, 43 in all, according to the General Accounting Office, total funding levels remain at nearly $20 billion or less than 0.1% of American GDP, placing us at the lowest levels relative to other industrialized countries. He also talks about how the effectiveness of job training has been directly limited by low funding levels. So I wanted to catch up with Harry because his point of view, regardless of if you work in academia, you work for a private sector company, you're an entrepreneur, you're a manager, understanding the what government is doing when it comes to the development of our workforce is part of the game. So here's Harry Holzer. Let's bring it in.
I guess to start off, would you mind giving just a quick background to the audience on yourself?
I am currently the John LaFarge Professor of Public Policy at the McCourt School of Public Policy at Georgetown. I'm also affiliated with Brookings, the Economic Studies Group, and the American Institutes for Research. I'm a former chief economist of the U.S. Department of Labor, and I'm a labor economist by training and spent roughly the last four decades studying low-wage workers, less skilled workers, and what might help them.
What is, if you were to sum up the last four decades in just a few sentences, what does it look like in labor?
Well, you know, I have chosen to focus on particular groups. I've done a lot of work on Black youth and Black men and the reasons for their low participation rates, low earnings rates. I've covered everything from discrimination and affirmative action to skill building to how employers deal with criminal records and things like that. I have worked on high-paying firms and why they choose to pay high and what impacts that has. I've focused on the education and workforce system. So I've covered a lot of issues in my time. Immigration, minimum wage issues, et cetera.
Your recent article in Brookings titled, Should the Federal Government Spend More on Workforce Development? For those that haven't read it yet, I mean, could you give a quick background on it and why you wrote it?
Sure. I was called to testify before the House Subcommittee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. That's part of the House Committee on Education and Labor. And I was making these arguments. A major piece of legislation, the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, often called WIOA, is up for reauthorization in the House. They're trying to figure out what kind of bill they want to write. And so I addressed some basic issues, and I focused in on the question of the amount of funding in that entire package is so paltry relative to our needs, relative to what we spent in the past, relative to what other countries do. I want to say, you know, we really need an injection of new resources there, as well as some specific priorities, I think, to focus on.
To that point, you said kind of we don't spend enough. I think it's quoted at 0.1% of GDP relative, and that's put in comparison, other countries are spending as much as five times that. But you also mentioned that what we're doing maybe not necessarily be working. You mentioned kind of many employers feel federal job programs may be wasteful or ineffective. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. I mean, so first of all, we got to be careful about what do we mean by workforce development programs? Because one of the unusual things in the American system is you have this body of legislation coming out of the Department of Labor and a set of institutions that they used to call one-stop shops. Now they're called American Job Centers. A lot of that is distinct from the higher education system. And you might say, well, higher education is different, degree programs are different, but the lower end of higher ed, you know, especially community colleges and for-profit schools, contain a lot of certificate programs, both for academic credit and not for credit, that overlap with what we usually call job training. So we do have to be careful about exactly what we're talking about. But if you focus on the WIOA piece, the evaluation evidence has been very mixed. There are some studies, including one major one that I authored, where the returns look decent for at least some pieces for the adult training programs. There's also some evidence that the one-stops are fairly effective. But I think we're stuck in what you might call a low-dollar, low-impact equilibrium or situation where, on the one hand, the dollars are so small that the impacts just can't be very good. It just isn't enough for serious training. But as long as the evaluation impacts don't look good, Congress is reluctant to put more resources. So you're stuck in this situation. I think that's going to be hard to get out of with relatively weak evidence based on relatively weak spending. There are other parts of that system that perform much better. Some parts of the community college system do better. And then we have the set of what we call sectoral training programs, where workforce developers work hand in hand with key employer and industry groups in high demand, high wage industries to really get a sense of exactly what kind of training do they want, to carefully provide that training and to send really good people to the employers and, you know, that the employers need very badly. Some of those programs are really outstanding and have long and lasting positive impacts. The problem is they're all quite small, and it would be expensive to scale them up. And there's lots of issues about what to do about workers that aren't quite well prepared. So again, you know, there's the federal WIOA programs have a somewhat mixed track record. There's other pieces of the system that look very bright, and the question is, can we do more to build on the things that look effective?
I was saying that, so I've been sitting on the Newark Workforce Board for 2 years now, and I run a startup tech company, and wanting to get involved and engage in the community, I've been able to kind of learn a lot in observation. And one of the things that struck me about when I read your article and was finished reading it, was this question of what can companies do? You know, I mean, again, from the, obviously there's a whole, there's the whole WIOA reauthorization and what happens, you know, on the public side. But as a private sector company, what would you say to me as a talent leader, C-level executive, CFO, what is it my responsibility or opportunity that I should engage in to make sure that we're, you know, we're playing our part in our communities to make sure that these programs are the most effective?
Well, you know, companies' first interest is in being generating profits, you know, especially if they're a public company, for their shareholders, and if they're not a public company, for themselves. And I get that. We don't expect them to do anything differently. And of course, a lot of companies, especially large companies, have effective job training programs internally that they've devised, you know, career ladders and sometimes all kinds of work-based learning and incumbent worker training that work quite well for them. But there's clearly a set of industries where that's not sufficient to meet their needs and the needs of the economy, you know, especially these high demand. And we know what the industries are, right? Healthcare, advanced manufacturing, transportation, logistics, IT, and some others. So it's helpful if employers in those industries work with their industry association to develop these sector partnerships and perhaps to advocate for what would work better from their point of view. And it would be nice if they, and again, I think some companies already do this very well, but some of the smaller companies have more difficulty with it. They don't quite know how to invest the dollars, where to find the talent, you know, and especially in a tight labor market like the one that we've had, where you have these ongoing worker shortages. So companies that work with their industry associations and that let their local workforce boards, their state workforce boards, maybe speak on federal issues to generate more resources, but then to say, but this is what we would find most effective. You know, and I don't think companies should call all the shots, right? Because again, companies are going to be looking from their own perspective at what works. You know, and for instance, a company today might need, I don't know, 100 welders or machinists. Tomorrow that might all get automated. You know, those investments might no longer be, right? So we don't want to look only from the company's perspective. You know, and a lot of employers have a tendency to say, we don't really care about credentials. We don't care about degrees that community colleges, you know, we need exactly this. But as a society, we also have to worry beyond the interests of that employer. We want workers to get training that is portable if they leave that employer, even if they leave that industry, and that will enable them over time to build and to have strong careers. So the employers need to get more engaged, but we can't rely, and we need to try to meet their needs. And they will often talk about what their needs are in terms of incumbent worker training and maybe some help with work-based learning, customized training. But that's an important piece. That can't be the only piece and the only voice, I think, of who we pay attention to. But again, it's very important, you know, and I do think a lot of American employers are skeptical of this entire system. You know, there's always a tension between, historically, these systems have been mostly oriented towards helping disadvantaged workers. And employers say, but I'm not in the business of helping disadvantaged workers. I'm in the business of, you know, running my business and trying to generate profits and finding really highly skilled. And the sector-based training programs, the best of them have been very good at that, taking the employer perspective very seriously and trying to meet them where they are and to send them candidates that they need. Sometimes the employers might then have to step up to the table as well and generate work-based learning opportunities, you know, get involved with curriculum building, et cetera. So employers are very important. They're not the only voice, but they're an important voice.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that 50% of all Americans over 25 still have no post-secondary education or training credential.
That's right.
You know, I think that in what you just said a second ago about portability and maybe even stackability, it feels like employers at times want, I think it, and I'm interested to hear your point of view on this, if there's any data you've seen around it, but feels like during COVID, HR teams got skinnied down a little bit in a lot of environments. You know, companies scaled back in certain areas. Where do they scale back? Marketing, human resources, and the labor shortage. In some ways, were because organizations didn't have anybody at the controls, and they were bringing folks back into human resources while they were also trying to find talent. And in finding talent, this challenge of workers being able to show the world what they know. I don't know. I always struggle with the word low-skilled and unskilled from a moral perspective, given that I think that if a society hasn't allowed the worker to signal what they know on paper the same way a four-year degree does, you know, can a company or can a society really call somebody unskilled? I don't know what your thoughts are.
I think that's a very important issue. And this is always a question of information and how do you, in fact, signal to employers what you know. And when the information is very imperfect, you fall back on a credential to sort of signal, a credential that people understand. There's also a separate problem of the sort of proliferation of credentials short of degrees in a lot of cases, and employers having no idea what they really mean, and workers have no idea. But we use credentials when the information is imperfect. Now that has limitations because not everybody can get a degree and not everybody can get a credential. So I think there is a growing consensus that we need to move in the direction of what some people call skills-based hiring rather than credentials-based hiring, to really spend a little more time finding out what workers know and what skills they bring to the table based on whatever they've done in the education world, whatever they've done, what prior work experience they have, any other licensure they have, or, you know, but there's a big question of how do you do that? You know, how is it that, in fact, you pay less attention to those credentials and what information, how do you generate that information? And how can the employer really trust it, or test its validity? There's some great work being done in that area. There's an organization called Opportunity at Work that's working with a bunch of companies to develop what they call wallets, of things that workers can do to show what they know. There's a whole budding movement about what they call prior learning assessment by companies, but also by schools to try to give workers more credit when they walk in the door. So I think that all that movement is important. It makes sense that in a worker shortage environment, you're seeing more of that, right? I mean, in a recession, it's an employer-driven market, and employers have their pick over workers, a surplus of workers. But now you're in a labor shortage environment, and companies just aren't getting the candidates whom they really want. So they have to work a little harder to find out. It's in their interest to work a little harder, and I think it's incumbent on all of us, including the public system, to try to help them do more of that.
Barry, I appreciate you taking time. One final question for you. Ask folks, you know, given that we're talking about future of work, obviously the reauthorization of WIOA is really important as we think about creating a world where, in a society where every worker can compete and have the opportunity to be successful. What is your hope for the future of work?
Well, you know, I think we're going to be in a world where there's a lot of automation is going to go on. We've already had that kind of world. It's probably going to grow. You know, I think the right way to think about artificial intelligence and robotics is that it's going to automate specific tasks, not necessarily entire jobs, but specific tasks. Now, if those tasks are only 20, 30% of what a worker does, it might well be in the employer's interest to help them pivot, pick up a few new responsibilities. If it's 50 or 70 or 80% of what they do, there's a much greater chance that they're going to get laid off. We want to build a system where people can retool fairly quickly find, you know, if the tasks that they were able to perform are now automatable and better done by machines, how can they pivot towards skills that are complementary with the automation rather than being fully replaced by it? You know, there are cliches around lifelong learning, but we have to sort of build a system where workers can plug into a relearning, retraining environment. We want to build a system where I think employers help their employees do more of that rather than just letting them go. But we also want to build a system where it's relatively easy for workers, number one, to get the information that they need about what skills they have, where they can build on that, and number two, figure out how to get the extra training. There's a lot to be done. You know, I can imagine part of it is about retraining subsidies to employers. I can imagine some of it is about lifelong learning accounts. Some of it is about working with the community colleges and some of the private colleges to make themselves more effective. And by the way, you know, online learning might play an increasingly important role in this. Online learning didn't work so well during the pandemic, but it kind of stands to reason that you can automate some parts of learning, combine it with the human touch in the right places, and that could make all of the training more accessible to adults who, you know, need to work full time and, you know, and provide for their families. But that's what I'm looking for, a system where when automation occurs and when some of people's tasks get automated, people and businesses can more quickly pivot to what else these people know, help them learn something. And in that kind of world, everybody will benefit from the automation, you know, not just the employers trying to improve their profit margins. But that's what I'm looking for down the road. And also to have high quality jobs that pay more, that require a higher level of skills, where employers are willing to pay more for the talent. And workforce development is an important piece of that, I think.
Barry, it's great. Thank you for taking the time. Great to meet you.
Same here, Sam.
You know, I think we live at a time with an abundance of information that's available at our fingertips. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to talk to Harry, given his expertise, deep expertise in this domain, it's so critical when you think about the way in which companies throw terms around when they talk about workers today. When you hear, it's definitely a clear divide. Some organizations get it. They invest deeply into their workforce. They involve themselves in the community. They understand that certain workers at certain corners of their workforce have different advantages and disadvantages. And then it's very clear today that there are some organizations that simply are more transactional with their workforce. And, you know, for that reason, I thought Harry, I really enjoyed having this conversation. A few things that stood out to me that I wrote down here. Job training stuck in a low dollar, low impact rut. You know, talking about the fact that there's just not enough funding to commit to long enough, effective job training that truly makes a difference. Very transactional, very check the box. Wow, we could talk about that for a long time. But it's so true. You see it in private sector, not just in government programs. You're talking about training needing to be mobile. It gives people skills that are transferable from job to job. You know, Harry said, as a society, needing to look beyond the needs of the employers. Again, just wow. I mean, totally. The responsibility of a society is to invest in the people in your community without any expectation that they may even be with you forever. You know, it's that old saying that, you know, you may see come across your LinkedIn feed that has been repurposed dozens of times. It's, you know, what happens if you train the person and they leave? And it's like, oh, well, what happens if you train them if you don't train them and they stay? But in both models, it's this perspective that the employer controls the learning of the worker. We've got to get away from that and give more access and more opportunity to owning the things that you learn. I thought that was something Harry was talking to. And the final thing I wrote down, we said, you know, there are cliches around lifelong learning, but we have to sort of build a system where workers can plug into learning and a retraining environment. the way the jobs are going to shift and change, you know, over the next decade. You know, again, change has always been a constant, and jobs are going to continue to change. And AI, automation, robots, the move in the labor market to more healthcare-related work and pink-collar jobs, this is going to be a trend that occurs in organizations and communities. And as a nation, we need to be really great, because we can be, at offering workers the opportunity to reskill and retrain. You know, final thing to point out, I mean, Harry's hope for the future of work: build a system where people can retool quickly. We have to build a system, and by the way, high quality jobs that pay more, that'd be pretty cool too. So I want to thank Harry for taking time to join us and have this conversation in between, you know, teaching and testifying in front of Congress, all that other stuff, writing books and articles. You know, really appreciative of him taking a second to talk to us about such an important issue. Now, don't forget to subscribe to Bring It In so you never miss an episode. We've got some awesome guests lined up that you're not going to want to miss. Now, back to work.